Shank Bagley. Shank Bagley. Shank Bagley. Hello and welcome to Shatbaggly, an old Lincolnshire adjective to describe absolutely anything loose and disorderly, which sums up this Lincolnshire lass quite nicely. In a moment, we'll hear about a food writer before Mrs. Beaton, what we need in our store cupboard if we want to cook Indian cuisine, and what is Mr. Gordon Ramsay really like. First though, with it being episode 17, here are a few other things with the same number. Bottle banks in the UK in 1977. We now have more than 50,000 of them. Inches of a human bottom allowed in the specification for seat width for the British Rail Sprinter train in the 80s. And the most hair rollers put on in 1 minute whilst on a roller coaster. As you do. A record achieved by Julia and Stephanie Muller of Germany some 10 years ago. Hope all is well where you are in the world. I went to an osteopath early today. First time in over 20 years, so currently feel as if I've been run over. Apparently, my pelvis was out by a few inches. So you never know, I may be a whole different new woman now. Glyn's probably hoping that, especially after a very busy and extremely hot Ludlow Food Festival. That's where I caught up with superstar chef Stuart Collins, who was demonstrating on the Saturday. Stuart has worked in 2- and 3-star Michelin restaurants, including working alongside one of the best-known personalities in the industry, Gordon Ramsay. For fans of Great British Menu, you'll recognise Stuart when he took part and won the Central Region 2 years ago, gaining a whole new audience of fans with his standout dishes. Docket number 33 in Whitchurch, North Shropshire, is where you'll find him and his wife Fran. I can fully recommend. Fabulous place and food. But what did he think of Ludlow?
Wonderful weekend, absolutely brilliant, really warm, but really good to have a real full crowd as well, and it always helps, doesn't it? Really engaged crowd, and Ludlow's...
We didn't have special. To pay anybody either, did we?
No, they were here free of charge.
Because now it's raining, people will come and sit down, but no, it was sunny, and they, yeah, volunteer. Of course they will, because you're doing really well, and we've been working together for several years. You've
Many
just
years.
Grown and grown and grown.
Well, yeah, but it's through help of people like yourself who have given us a platform to showcase what we do. And, you know, it's invaluable to us. And, you know, it means a lot to work with you guys and, you know, various events throughout the year. And it's brilliant. And Ludlow is just the cream on the top, isn't it?
Your restaurant, for those whoever want to come to North Shropshire, Whitchurch, cracking little market town. But it kind of goes beyond because you've been all over the world cooking. I mean, was it New York? You were in Qatar. Have I missed something, another country?
No, that's about it. But done a bit of consultancy here, there and everywhere. And, you know, and it's brilliant. And the beauty, especially in Qatar, was having a, you know, real diverse brigade, 36 nationalities. So from all around the world and you know, family meal. Can you imagine every afternoon? And we would let one of the team members create the meal. And so you get this sort of authentic cooking from, you know, Eastern Europe, Southeast Asia, or various parts of the world. And that was just a brilliant education. Even as the exec chef, you've got the junior team showcasing and teaching you on their cuisine. And it's so influential. Just what an amazing opportunity.
Would you short of anything over in Qatar? Because you kind of imagine very hot. Do things grow? I mean, I know that sounds probably a really stupid question, but what does grow?
Well, when we were there, nothing. As we were leaving, they built the first greenhouse, and it was for tomatoes. Everything else was imported. So we used to get two shipments coming from Runge's Market in Paris every week, and all our produce would come in, which was phenomenal. But you are at the mercy of what arrives. You can't return anything, of course, because, you know, it's a pretty expensive return. But, yeah, so everything was imported. And, you know, that's wonderful. We worked for a pretty good company with deep pockets, so what we got was brilliant. But, you know, you want sort of local produce. And that's why when Fran and I came back to the UK and we wanted to be in Shropshire, because that opportunity to work with local producers and growers and suppliers, to go to the farms, to go to their little production facilities and see how these things are made, that's what makes it so good to us. And that's the beauty of Shropshire, because it has everything here, you know, within a relatively short distance. It's all here.
It was interesting when we first started working together, and then we watched telly. It was on one of the channels, and there was, because you were with Gordon Ramsay, weren't you, for many years? And there you were on the telly as part of Hell's Kitchen, and you looked like a rabbit in headlights. It always made me smile. I don't think you even spoke, did you?
No, it was first opportunity, I think, on TV. Very daunting, you know, sort of eye pressure as well, because you want to represent the company and all the rest of it, and sort of represent yourself. But yeah, I guess when the camera actually cut to me, I think I froze, and that was it. But, you know, lesson learned, and a few years later on, it all came good. So.
Well, you were on our Great British Menu, and you won the Central Region with that most peculiar catchphrase that nobody, not even you, knows where it came from.
Yeah, no drama, baby llama. That was it. The catchphrase was born. But yeah, I mean, I don't know why I said that. I don't know where it came from. But it was one of those spur of the moment things. And it was natural and it was genuine. And it was brilliant. And to be on Great British Menu, I mean, wow, it was just phenomenal. Brilliant to represent the region, you know, to represent my home county, where we are as a business. And, you know, the counties that are dear to where I've grown up. And it was just brilliant. And then to bring a menu together that was sourced from within the region, representing amazing. My thing was inventors and innovators, so to be able to showcase those people through food, just an amazing opportunity. Absolutely brilliant.
What was he like then, Mr. Ramsay?
For me, with Gordon, love him or hate him, he is infectious. He is motivated. He is driven, and you know, it's always good fun. It's always entertaining being around him. He's a phenomenal chef. He's a world-leading chef. And to have him spend some time with me to show me to be a better chef, better leader, and one thing than another, it was just incredible. And when you think now of all the restaurants he's had around the world, all the chefs that have worked through his kitchens, the tens of thousands, millions of diners that have eaten in his restaurants and had the most memorable experiences, what an incredible person to spearhead that. And as I say, love him or hate him, he's a phenomenal individual. And I find it inspiring. I found it truly inspiring. So I loved it.
The lovely and hugely talented Stuart Collins from Docket 33 in Whitchurch, chatting at Ludlow Food Festival last weekend. I'll pop Stuart's details on Shat Bagley's Instagram and Facebook pages so you can follow what he's up to and hopefully visit. There's a waiting list to get in, though, which tells you everything. It was a successful event, although I ended up having to have my eye washed out by a paramedic in between two demonstrations. I think I perhaps got a little too close to a flying seed in a hot pan. Guess it's one way to meet people. Speaking of which, Suki Pantal I met for the first time there. Suki is an Indian home cook who was a contestant on the Great Cookbook Challenge with Jamie Oliver on the television last year, and now runs Suki's Curries and Spices cookery classes, as well as an Indian recipe blog on social media. Born in India and raised in New Delhi, Suki moved to the UK to be with her British Asian husband 8 years ago, who you'll hear she mentions as we chatted about cupboard essentials.
If you are starting as somebody who has not made Indian food before but want to try it, I think there are 5 ingredients which are easily available, which I'll suggest please have them in your store cupboard. One is please have ginger garlic paste lying somewhere. It's easy to use. You don't have to go and pound cloves. Then you should have cumin seeds. You should have garam masala, turmeric powder, and coriander powder, and you're sorted.
You got very excited when you said coriander powder. What is it with coriander in Indian cuisine?
Gosh, coriander powder adds such a lovely lemony flavour with a bit of spicy flavour to the dish. I always use it in most of my chicken curries and lamb curries.
Yes.
And vegetarian curries.
No, you just use it in your curry, Suki.
Yes, I do. I love coriander powder. But there are a lot of other spices as well, which probably once you get a hang of how to make Indian food, you can always have them. And that also includes cumin powder or dyed fenugreek powder. There is something called asafoetida. We'll go into that, Katie, probably in another podcast. That can take up a lot of time.
But just to spell it, probably we would need another podcast.
Yes, I'll make it easier. In Hindi, it's called hing.
Easy. Okay. I do like that.
Yeah, so spices galore. But the idea about spices is they're not supposed to overpower the dish. They're supposed to be there because they take it to another level. And it's also adding the spice at the right time. And that really makes your curry sing.
Okay. Something I'm going to say as somebody that does enjoy cooking curries, and I've learnt, and it's so important, maybe folk don't realise is the onions. You wouldn't think something as simple as onions, but to cook them, it's not just flinging in the pan and stir, it's for a while.
Absolutely. You know, Indian cooking is all about patience. I always say to my participants in my classes, you can't cook curry in a hurry. So onions do take their time, but once you get that beautiful brown colour, one, they add so much sweetness to your sauce. Secondly, it's the colour that comes from the onions, because they go in really literally in mostly in the initial part of the cooking process. And then you have these onions brown, then take your time over it, 7 minutes, 10 minutes, doesn't matter.
Now, you say about sweet, because I would have thought red is sweeter. Do you use red onions in a curry?
To be honest, I really don't use red, because I grew up eating white onions all my life. So Indian curry is generally made with white onions back home from where I am. So they added sweetness. So I'm sure red are further sweeter than that as well. But I've always used white. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, and who was it that inspired you to cook all those years ago? You mentioned grandma a few times.
Yes, it's my maternal grandmother, Katie. She's bless her. Her cooking was so simple and so delicious. My mum cooked as well. My dad loved my mum's cooking, so she was like always making these lovely dishes for all of us. My aunts, my mum's sisters cook. They're my inspiration. All four of them: my mum, her sisters, and my maternal grandmother. And so I just hope I can just make them proud by making all these dishes.
Oh, I'm sure you are. But I was conscious, though, you listed all the females in your family. Do fellas not cook in India?
I think I'm talking probably mostly the generations before me, my father's generation, my grandfather's generation. I don't think, probably one odd person must be a good cook or tried it, but generally as a rule, I don't think it was the domain. Kitchen was not really the domain. My dad, being in the army, very busy, kept a very hectic schedule. My mom used to cook. We had cooks as well in the army, but my mom was always in the kitchen. And so but the newer generation, just marvelous. My generation, the ones after me, the amount of love I've seen that people give in the kitchen, including both sexes, it's amazing. And yes, men are cooking now, but not from where I come.
Does your husband cook?
Oh gosh, no, he can't find his way around the kitchen. I have to give him a map.
Suki Pantel, a real character. And I must say thank you to Suki, as she kindly provided the team behind the scenes with our lunch. Delicious it was too. And you can see her dishes for yourself when I pop Suki's details on Shat Bagley's social media. My final guest is a man we heard about when food historian Sam Bilton joined us a few weeks ago, Dr. Neil Buttery. Neil has been writing on the history of British food for over 10 years, and through the process of writing and cooking has become a professional chef, specialising in cooking food from our past. He has his own British Food History podcast, and his current book, which we talk about, is Before Mrs. Beaton, Elizabeth Raffald. But first, congratulations were in order, as Neil's first title, A Dark History of Sugar, had just been awarded Best First Book at the Guild of Food Writers Awards.
Yes, sir, I was absolutely gobsmacked when they called my name out. It was all very surreal.
Oh, does that mean you hadn't written a speech as a thank you? Or had you jotted a few things?
Well, do you know what I had? Because I don't know about you, it's the kind of things that you have sleepless nights over. It's like, oh my God, what am I going to say?
Yeah.
So I thought I'd better write something just to help my own mental health in the run-up to it, because I knew I'd be nervous. So I wrote a few things down. But do you know what? I think they were aware that people get stressed, and there were no speeches. There were no thank yous.
So when you went up, it was just you took the reward and that was it? You went off?
Shook hands, had photographs done, and off you went back to your seat again.
Oh. Yeah. That just means everybody gets home early, but it's not very fun, is it?
Back to the drinking and eating canapes. That's why.
So that was the first one. And now, I mean, I was interested in the one that you've done, because I remember working at Arley Hall in Cheshire.
Oh, right. Okay.
Oh yes. Oh. And they sell... I want to use the word Eccles cakes, yeah. And that was Elizabeth Raffald's recipe.
Right, yes, they were called sweet patties in her book.
Right.
The recipe has changed slightly because she put chopped calves foot meat in hers.
Oh, no!
But apart from that, it's the same, you know. Well, essentially a mince pie, isn't it, I suppose, in puff pastry.
Yeah,
so, yeah, there's... We think she was the first person to come up with that.
Why would anybody else want to? But yeah. she was the forerunner, heck of a character as well, was Elizabeth. What was it about her that sparked your interest?
Well, when I first got into this English food and traditional food malarkey. I tried to cook every recipe in Jane Grigson's English Food, just as a project to help me practice writing, because I was going back to university, so I thought I need to practice just writing anything, and I liked cooking. So I was cooking through the books, and I eventually got to a recipe of Elizabeth Raffold's orange custards that Jane had interpreted and updated, and she wrote this potted biography, and I couldn't believe what I was reading, because the stuff that she'd done was just unbelievable. So that planted the seed. I went off and bought a copy of her book. It's the first historical cookbook that I bought. So really, Elizabeth Raffold and Jane Grigson are the two people who've been with me essentially from right from the start, you know, 15, 16 years ago when I started doing all this stuff.
So what era was Elizabeth in?
18th century, second half of the 18th, so early Georgian. You know, all big powdered wigs, all that kind of stuff.
Dreadful fire hazard.
Dreadful fire hazard, yeah. So really crazy fashion times. And it was just as the Industrial Revolution was just getting going. Certain elements of the world had become industrial. Food hadn't quite yet, but and the textiles areas hadn't quite yet, but it was almost there. So she cashed in, really, because all these cities were... Obviously, Manchester was where she ended up living. She knew it was all getting going, and she got there quick smart because she knew there wasn't a place that did upmarket food. She knew there wasn't enough servants to go around. She knew all these things. And as soon as she moved in there, she just set up. I mean, it seemed like she just set it up. It must have been hard work, but well, she did all this amazing stuff. She set up the first servants employment agency. She wrote the first, essentially, yellow pages of Manchester and Salford. There's 20,000 people living there at the time. You know, it's not a little pamphlet.
As you say, it wasn't just one thing she did. She was so ahead of her time. And and you say it, don't you? Before Mrs. Beaton. That's why you... What was the title?
The book's Before Mrs. Beaton. Then the subtitle is Elizabeth Raffold, England's Most Influential Housekeeper.
What else do we know about... What sort of age was she when she did all this? She wasn't very old, was she?
She became... housekeeper at Arley Hall when she was 25, which is young for a housekeeper of a large stately home. You'd be expected to have a certain amount of experience and gravity to you, and she obviously had it in spades because she was very successful at it. And then she was only there for 3 years, and she spent 18 years in Manchester. So all those things that she did 18 years. And she died suddenly, just dropped dead out of nowhere, and she was 47. And you just think, how did she do all of that? 47? But I mean, I think she bit.
That's maybe why she dropped dead at 47, because she did so much.
It was reckoned that she had 16 daughters. I couldn't find evidence for 16. I found evidence for 9.
Jeez.
But only 3 survived till adulthood. Oh. I mean, it was a time where there was high infant mortality in the upper classes, really, not the working classes. But I think she was just working too hard. She had miscarriages, and you know, obviously, quite rightly counted those perhaps as
so
children.
Relationship-wise, then, that's a lot of children. I don't think they were the same person, was it?
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah, she was married to John Raffold throughout her whole life. Oh. He was the head gardener at Arley Hall. They moved to Manchester. He went to work at the family. What are they called? Market gardens, where they grew really quite exotic fruit and veg. He was employed at Arley Hall to grow the exotic fruit and veg. He'd actually given up his own inheritance to the family business because he was the eldest son to go work his dream job in Arley.
Wow.
I mean, Elizabeth must have been quite the person to convince him to give up his dream job, move back to Manchester, and then he worked for his own brother, running the business that he'd passed down to him. Very strange. What conversation went on there? I've got no idea.
It must have been the wig.
It must have been the wig, yeah. Call it lead oxide in the makeup.
So did she outlive John?
No. John lived to a ripe old age, to his 80s. I mean, their last big project was a massive tavern. And John was working front of house because he was apparently handsome and charismatic. But he had to do a lot of drinking. There was a lot of drinking going on. It was at the times of like the Beefsteak Club, you know, all these really big societies, which was just an excuse for men to get drunk, but you'd be expected to match drinks, you know. So he was being off front of house and essentially became an alcoholic. He started taking his eye off the ball. There were some major thefts. He was drinking the bar dry. And all the stuff that she'd have, you know, she made thousands of pounds from her books, all gone and went bankrupt. And then they set up a dodgy coffee house, basically, which she didn't have much to do with. And 2 years into that, she died. And he just went bankrupt and absconded. He absconded to London, came back a few years later to teetotaler.
It's what an incredible story. I'm going to have to read your
and
book.
And no one knows about her. And then not only that, the important thing, I suppose, is her book, Experienced English Housekeeper. After she died, the publisher sold the copyright to other people. So it got changed, it got pirated, it got recipes taken out, other people's recipes in. Other writers just plagiarised her work. So what you find is, whether you knew it or not, you were using her recipes to cook from. And at that point, you know, the late 18th century, it's the first time we get a national cuisine, because people are cooking, people, I don't know, in Newcastle, for the first time, are eating the same things as people down in Exeter, because they've all got Elizabeth's recipes. And then with that knowledge, you go back and look at a book, and you go, oh, God, it's just a book of traditional British food. She essentially she didn't invent it, she didn't invent that many dishes, but she really created what we think of as today, anyway, as traditional British food. No one's heard of her.
No, so it's only when you go to Arley Hall and it may mention Elizabeth Raffald, but if you don't, you don't. So
And the people who do know her really appreciate her. But yeah, we're few and far between, so I thought, right.
Yes.
Got to do something about this. And
yes.
I was very happy, I'm very lucky that my publisher was happy about me writing about somebody that nobody had heard of. which is why we put Mrs. Beaton in the title. Yeah. Or one of the reasons why we put Mrs. Beaton in the title, because if anybody knows a historical cook, it's going to be Mrs. Beaton. Yeah.
Where's she rated then on one of your heroes and food heroes? Now you've written about, you've known more about her. Because it's one thing maybe knowing a little bit, but you now know her inside out.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, she's the apex. Yeah, you don't get better. There's never going to be another Elizabeth Raffald again. You know, it's people say, oh, she was like the Delia Smith of the day, the Nigella Lawson of the day. Well, I mean, as much as I love and respect those two, they've got absolutely nothing. Nothing on her. You know, I mean, talk about, you know, she's doing all these different things. She's a magician. I don't know how she managed to do all the things that she did. It's just absolutely crazy.
Dr. Neil Buttery and his book all about the phenomenal Elizabeth Raffald. Arley Hall in Cheshire is where you'll find her sweet patties, or Eccles cakes, still being made, minus the chopped calf's feet. And congratulations again to Neil. And he's working on his next project, which is going to be the history of baking. So we're definitely looking forward to that. Staying with baking, you know me, I like to look at sort of vintage recipe books and old bits and pieces. Came across a vintage 1930s dinner party recipe book, which has a picture amongst trifles and Victoria sponges of what we would call a Battenberg cake, but it's labelled a Russian cake, which I'm totally confused. Battenberg, I thought, originated in England. I did a bit of research. Early recipes, such as Agnes Bertha Marshall in 1898. She called it, though, the Domino Cake, so it's had a few names. But I've never, ever heard it referred as a Russian cake. I'll put the picture of it up on Instagram and Facebook and see what you think. So any thoughts on it, do let me know, because, yeah, a bit baffled. Just looking ahead to next week, we're going to hear a little more from Ludlow Food Festival, as we'll chat with fisheries journalist Mike Warner from Suffolk and Pervin and Cyrus Toddywaller OBE from Cafe Spice Namaste in London, and hopefully another couple of guests too, as once again, Glyn and I are on the road this weekend, heading to North Wales. Thank you as ever for getting in touch. Really love hearing from you, be it social media or email, podcast@theshackbagley.co.uk. And I always say, if you feel the urge to leave a review, please don't fight it. And I hope you're following or subscribing too, as it does help when I do ask guests to join us. Oh, and by the way, if you tuned in last week, yes, I did manage to introduce Chef Felice Tacchini in Italian. That's probably why my pelvis decided to move. So that's it for another week. Thank you for listening, and see you next time. Or Arrivederci.